thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. In an effort to bring you diverse points of view, we start out with Alan Weissman and Steve Curwood discussing the hot-button issue of reducing population. And then we go to alternate medicine under the microscope and follow up with climate change and the bottom line.
Author Alan Weissman's last book, the bestseller The World Without Us, imagines what the world might be like if there were no humans. Well, his new book, Countdown, examines a vastly different reality, a world with what might be way too many humans. Those seem like two dark futures, so we called him up to ask him about this latest work. Alan, welcome back to Living on Earth.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to be back.
Alan, your previous book, The World Without Us, was, well, let's face it, very dark. How fair is it to characterize this work as hopeful?
Well, Steve, I didn't consider The World Without Us dark. To me, it was very hopeful to realize that nothing that we do to this planet ultimately is going to harm it. In this book, I really show a way that we can continue to have a world with us, that gradually, not coercively, we can bring our numbers back down to a much more reasonable balance with the rest of nature. We can curb the amount of people who are emitting carbon into the atmosphere. That's really one of the most hopeful things that we can possibly be doing right now. Plus, it doesn't cost very much. We could provide contraception worldwide for everybody for the same amount every year, about $8.5 billion, that your country and mine was spending in Iraq and Afghanistan every month.
At one point, you outline four questions in the book as the most important questions on Earth. One of the four questions you investigate is, what is the planet's carrying capacity? Can you speak to that for me, please?
Well, a lot of experts who have kind of made a stab at what might be a reasonable number for us. Some of them have looked at energy, trying to figure out how much carbon the atmosphere really can bear. You divide all that stuff up, and you start coming out with numbers in the 2 to 3 billion range. It turns out that it's hard to know exactly what the optimum number is, because we're at the number that we're at right now.
Which is about 7 billion-ish or so?
It's about 7.2 billion right now. And it's one of these things that sort of creeps up on us gradually. You know, every few days there's a million more and you don't really notice till suddenly you turn around and you say, oh my God, there's all this carbon dioxide in the air. Look what it's starting to do.
The first question's about the Earth's carrying capacity. Tell us about the other three and just briefly sum up the answer for each.
The second one, the converse, how much nature do we need? Are there any species that are absolutely essential? And the answer to that one turns out to be, we really won't know until it's too late. If we push something off the planet that, oops, we probably should have saved that. You don't notice that one species is gone. You don't notice that a second species is gone. Suddenly, when there are 1,000 species gone, well, then we start to have a real problem.
So that's the second question. What's the third question?
The third question was, okay, suppose we could determine what would be an optimum population, or decided at least that the 7.2 billion that we have right now are just way too many because we're really bursting the seams. Would the great range of the world's cultures and religions and nationalities embrace the idea that this would be in their self-interest? You know, the Chinese draconian policy is not going to fly almost anywhere else. So I ended up going to 21 countries for this book to sort of take the pulse of the world's cultures and to see if there is something in their histories. And it turns out I found something everywhere. I was in lots of Muslim countries. I was in the Vatican. I was in Israel. I mean, here's one example. Let's go back to Genesis. There is a charge to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. But then you get to Joseph, who was one of 13 children, you know, the son of Jacob. He was very observant, and he realized that the world was moving into a cycle of scarcity. He had only one wife. He held himself to only two children, and he convinced the Pharaoh of Egypt that in order to save his country, that they literally had to refrain from embracing for a while and to conserve. As a result, you know, Egypt got through the famine.
And the fourth question?
The fourth question is, how do we design an economy that would allow us to prosper without constant growth? Constant growth is usually the measure by which we determine whether an economy is healthy or not. constant economic growth depends on population growth. You have to have more consumers, and you have to have more laborers.
Why is population control still such a reviled notion, even with so many red flags that, however you do the math, the human population is outweighing the planet's carrying capacity for humans?
Well, you know, making copies of ourselves is something that every organism on the planet does. It's doing what comes naturally. And the idea of having to limit it is sort of an unnatural act. There is something instinctively reflexive that finds the idea of having to control that, or worse, being told that you have to control it, utterly repellent. No species is created with an idea of limitations. You know, you make not just copies of yourself, but you make extra copies of yourself and hope that some of them will survive. The human race, like every other species, used to lose an awful lot of those extra copies. In the 19th century, we suddenly changed the game. We invented all kinds of medical advances, from vaccinations to eradication of pests to pasteurization of milk. And then we came up with food technology that greatly increased the amount of plant life that the Earth could produce by itself. The fact is, we have really manipulated nature when it comes to human survival.
Now, why do you think that it's going to be easier to get a balance here by curbing birth rather than using technology, you know, cleaner energy, more food, that sort of thing?
The fact is, we're not developing solar, wind, and other kinds of clean technologies to the point that they can usurp the more conventional ways of producing energy.
What about the prospect of consuming less?
There's also the question of consumption. Everybody says, well, if we only consumed less, then the world would be much better and cleaner and much more sustainable. You know, I think it was Paul Ehrlich who said to me, it's a great idea, but I've never found a condom for consumption. The quickest way that we can deal with environmental issues right now is simply to curb the number of consumers who are pumping out all that carbon.
If the Earth can't hold the 10 billion we're on track for that matter, the 7 billion we have now, how do you build an economy around a shrinking population?
Well, one of the places I went to in this book is Japan, which is the first country on Earth, really, that is facing the fact that its population is shrinking. At the end of World War II, they had to cut off their baby boom because people were starving. So they legalized abortion. This was before, you know, modern contraception, and that was the fastest way to do it. And as a result, they're going to be back to their post-World War II population by around the middle of the century, a little bit after. I found a Japanese economist who's been thinking about this a lot. His name is Akihiko Matsutani. He says it's really an opportunity for Japan to reorient itself. Instead of depending on heavy export industries that load people into these port cities, it's going to be a time of lighter consumer industries. The cheaper place to live, labor will actually become very valuable.
But Japan right now, though, is in an economic funk. It had this great expansion in the 80s, but then it's been in stagnation almost 2 decades now.
Well, Japan is kind of in denial over what it's facing. But frankly, you know, economic stagnation in Japan would look really good to most of the people on Earth. You still go to Japan, and people are prosperous. People are living well.
Alan, this is a very thoughtful and almost exhaustive study of these questions. What do you hope comes out of your book?
Well, there's something very inexpensive that is a win-win or a triple or quadruple win situation for everybody that can help turn around population growth significantly in this century. Encourage women to get educated. Turns out that education is the best contraceptive of all. A girl who gets into high school worldwide, on the average, is going to have 2 children. If she gets a degree, she's going to delay her childbearing until her college is over. She's going to have something very useful to both her family and her society. The idea that educating women can help solve this environmental problem and at the same time bring equality. You know, population, as one of my sources explained to me, is where social science and natural science come together. Right now, they're colliding. We can really make them mesh the way that everything in an ecosystem ought to do.
Alan Weissman's book, Countdown, is out now from Little Brown. Alan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
You're welcome, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
In a little hovel in far away a stand, an edifice of sticks and mud stands guard against the sand. A pot is set to boil to warm a little gruel, but the morn so far away it's holding something cruel. Things are never what they seem in this land or in that, but count on it, a profit's made by that little fact. Someone gets the silver and someone gets the sword. Someone always makes a buck from a making goods for war. Far away across the sea, a shiny silver shape sends special delivery to rendezvous with fate. And soon the little pot of gruel is blasted into bits, and now the note on someone's file among the confirmed hits. Things are never what they seem in this land or in that, but count on it, a profit's made by that little fact. Oh, someone gets the silver and someone gets the sword. Someone always makes a buck from a making goods for war. Not just far away as Stan sees the day's remains, the pilot's decorated, the report's tucked away. The boss's great big bonus reflects the goods he made. Then made their mark so far away that far away stand they. Things are never what they seem in this land or in that, but count on it, a profit's made by that little fact. Oh, someone gets the silver and someone gets the sword. Someone always makes a buck from a making goods reward.
Alternate medicine, from herbs to acupuncture to supplements, is big business in America. Now a prominent doctor says it's been way oversold. Dr. Paul Offit and Terry Grossman and Tom Ashbrook discuss the ins and outs of this controversial issue.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. About half of Americans use alternative medicine or of one kind or another these days. 10% use it on their children. It is a $34 billion a year industry, and an industry with almost no oversight. Vitamins, nutritional supplements, acupuncture, touch therapy, herbs, hormones, shark cartilage, milk thistle. It's an enormous realm. My guest today says we've gone too far down this path, that we're fooling ourselves and hurting ourselves, believing in magic. This hour on Point, a big skeptic's hard new look at alternative medicine. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you ready to fight for your milk thistle, your echinacea? Are we fooling ourselves? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear later in this hour from a big alternative medicine practitioner, but joining me now from Northfield, New Jersey is Dr. Paul Offit, author of the new book, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Dr. Offit is Chief of Infectious Diseases and Director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, professor of pediatrics at UPenn School of Medicine, co-inventor of the vaccine for rotavirus, credited for saving hundreds of infants' lives daily. Dr. Paul Offit, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Boy, you are tough on this big world that so many Americans have embraced. We'll look at exactly where your criticism goes, but if it's so bad, why do you think so many Americans have embraced at least a part of it, and a lot of Americans, a lot of it?
Because I think we do believe in magic. I think we look for that medicine that makes everything okay. And at some level, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, for example, if your doctor tells you to take chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine because you have joint pain, it's not going to hurt you. And although there are studies done showing that it's not any better than placebo, it certainly is might work as a placebo. And if it means that you can feel better and avoid things like nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory or COX-2 inhibitors like Celebrex or Bextra, that's great. Where you get into trouble here is for something like the concentrated garlic. I mean, if you look at these products like Garlicin or Garlic, it says on the label for cardiovascular health. And what that means is it's the wink and nod of this industry is that there's a notion out there that it lowers bad cholesterol, so-called low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not true. I mean, it's a very easy study to do. It's been done by the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. It doesn't lower LDL cholesterol. Now, if you're a person who has high cholesterol and you have a risk for cardiovascular disease and you choose to take that instead of statins like, say, Lipitor, yep, you're making a choice that could really hurt you. That's where alternative medicine, I think, fails.
So there's garlic and cholesterol. You describe an enormous realm of other examples here, many, many 50,000 plus supplements and vitamins and on and on. But you're quite candid in saying that you see the root of this in no small part going to a kind of disillusionment with modern medicine.
Fair enough. I think modern medicine has its limits. I guess the point I'm trying to make in this book is just because one is disillusioned with certain aspects of modern medicine doesn't mean that alternative medicine should get a free pass. This industry shouldn't exist under an untouchable halo, and I think one should bring the same level of skepticism that one brings to conventional medicine to this industry as well, because remember, it's an industry.
How do you define alternative medicine? What are the boundaries of what you're looking at, what you're not looking at?
Well, I guess I could look at this in two ways. One, you could argue there's no such thing as alternative medicine. If alternative medicine works, then one could simply call it medicine. And if an alternative medicine doesn't work, then it's not an alternative. I guess for the purpose of this book, I've sort of put that under the alternative medicine under categories like homeopathy, naturopathy, acupuncture, chiropractic, and these megavitamins as well as dietary supplements.
Are megavitamins different from just daily vitamins, or is that the same thing?
No, very different. So daily vitamins or so-called multivitamins usually contain at or about the recommended daily allowance of vitamins that we should be taking. Certainly vitamins are necessary for us to convert food into energy. By megavitamins, what I mean is quantities of vitamins vastly in excess of this recommended daily allowance or RDA, often 5 times, 8 times, 10 times, 20 times that. I mean, if you pop, for example, 1,000 milligram of vitamin C into your mouth and easily swallowed, I mean, that's the equivalent. That's 8 times the recommended daily allowance. You'd have to eat 14 oranges to get that or 8 cantaloupes to get that amount. And maybe your stomach is only so big for a reason and you shouldn't, you know, mess around with Mother Nature. Don't take these large quantities of supplements when they can certainly be hurtful. And now we know that megavitamins certainly can be hurtful. This is the most amazing thing, actually, in the writing of this book for me, is that if you look at people who take large quantities of vitamin A, vitamin E, beta carotene, which is an A precursor in selenium, they increase the risk of cancer, increase the risk of heart disease, and shorten their life. Vitamins contained or taken as large doses can hurt you, and most people don't know that because the industry essentially markets it away.
Can we back up for a second? 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C. I've taken that for stretches of time and fancied that I had fewer colds and felt terrific. Have I hurt myself?
I think you can potentially hurt yourself. Certainly if you take it, I think once when you have a cold or occasionally when you have colds, you're not going to hurt yourself. But if you take it sort of on a more regular basis, as many people do with some of these megavitamins, including celebrities who are often sort of in our face and telling us to do this, you can potentially hurt yourself. It's certainly true that vitamin C doesn't prevent colds and doesn't treat colds. But you could argue that believing that your cold is getting better means something. And I think probably goes a long way to helping you get better. But, you know, if we're going to use these things as placebos, then why don't we just use placebos, you know, like a sugar pill?
You write about the hope business, and you cite the example, sad example, of Steve Jobs, founder of Apple in particular, and his cancer. What happened there? Remind us.
Right. So Steve Jobs had pancreatic cancer. And I think when we hear that, we assume largely correctly that that equals a death sentence. But that's a different kind of tumor. That's an adenocarcinoma than what he had. He had a neuroendocrine tumor that just happened to be in his pancreas. If you look at the historic data, people have a 95 to 100% chance of survival if they just have early surgery associated with that pancreatic tumor. He chose to wait, not have surgery, instead chose this alternative route of acupuncture and bowel cleansings and sort of large quantities of fruit and vegetable juices. And by the time he had surgery, it was too late. I mean, he really had made a choice to, I'm sure unknown to him, but he made a choice to really end his life prematurely. It's sad.
But he was looking for something other than what was on offer from modern medicine. And obviously, millions and millions of people are in that same frame of mind. I mean, you've been out talking about this and about this book. Do you find an American public receptive to your argument or pushing back and saying, come on, doctor, we're way down this road, too late. This is what we do today.
Yeah, B, way down this road, too late. I think that it's a religion. You know, when you choose to sort of hold this religion up to scrutiny and you've attacked at some level the church of vitamins and supplements, you get tremendous pushback, including from the industry, including from industry lobbyists. And I've certainly gotten that pushback, but because it's an industry. It's interesting. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a year or so ago, and it followed two studies that were done, excellent studies. One was in the New England Journal of Medicine about these megavitamins. And what they found was just what I'd said before, that it actually surprisingly increased one's risk of cancer and heart disease. And the title of that article in the Wall Street Journal was, "Is this the end of popping vitamins? You know, can we really convince people that the data are what they are?" And there was a spokesman for the industry that said, "We just ignore these studies. This doesn't affect our business," because they know that with advertising, that people are going to be far more likely to watch commercials than they are to read the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the American Medical Association. And they're right. They can make it so that consumers don't know these risks.
And remind us of why, if these are put forward as health solutions, kind of medical alternative, but medical solutions, why is there no oversight or regulation?
Because in 1994, we, the government of the United States, created something called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which was called rightly by the New York Times the Snake Oil Protection Act. Because what that did was that essentially removed the Food and Drug Administration from oversight of this industry. So now these companies didn't really have to prove their claims or admit their harms. And I think we suffered that. It was an education act that had nothing to do with education and everything to do with the consumer not knowing what they're buying.
So the vitamins, the supplements, all of it, none of it's tested. It's all just based, when people take these, on the faith of whoever makes it or whoever's on TV promoting it?
Right. But remember, this industry can't make specific medical claims. So it's the wink and nod claim. It's the joint support formula, the prostate support formula, the heart support formula. They're not allowed to say, for example, shrinks your prostate, because the minute they do that, they've made a specific medical claim and they will fall under the FDA. And if you look on those bottles, they all say, you know, this is not intended for treatment of a specific disease. You have to look closely on the bottle to see that, but it does say that.
Are you just a prisoner of Western medicine, blind to the, you know, centuries, eons old wisdom of the East? And the, you know, I mean, this is how these things are often put, that there's a lot of wisdom that Western medicine has just looked past, kind of in its hubris, that we need to tap to become more whole and organic and more well.
Right. Yeah. The term Western medicine is one I actually don't understand. I mean, certainly the medicine that we practice, for example, in the United States, that has influences from all over the world. I mean, to me, it's always about the scientific method. I mean, if you're going to make a claim, a medical claim, a scientific claim, you can prove that or not prove that in a scientific or medical study. So that's what I ask for here, just evidence. And this sort of appeal to the ancients, this notion of ancient wisdom. I mean, if the ancients were so wise about health and disease, they certainly were remarkably quiet about it. Maybe it's because most of them never lived past 30.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's love affair with alternative medicine. It's a $34 billion business of supplements and acupuncture and touch. One big doctor says it's wrong, unproven, and maybe dangerous. Dr. Paul Offit is with us. His new book is Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. It is, of course, not hard to find big proponents of exactly the kind of treatments that Dr. Offit is so critical of. Here's Dr. Mehmet Oz from television's Dr. Oz, promoting alternative medicine. And this was 2010, discussing his belief in alternative medicine.
And I know firsthand the amazing miracles we can achieve with modern Western medicine. But I also know that for centuries, people around the world have developed alternative therapies to treat the body, mind, and the soul. So today, I'm revealing my ultimate alternative medicine secrets. If you've got a medical problem you can't solve, you may find the answer in the next few minutes.
There's Dr. Oz.
In this address, FDR answers his critics that have accused him of a breakfast menu that includes grilled millionaires.
You may have heard for 6 years that I was about to plunge the nation into war, that you and your little brothers would be sent to the bloody fields of battle in Europe, that I was driving the nation into bankruptcy, and that I breakfasted every morning on a dish of grilled millionaire. Actually, I am an exceedingly mild-mannered person, a practitioner of peace, both domestic and foreign, a believer in the capitalistic system, and for my breakfast, a devotee of scrambled eggs.
And now for something completely different.